Welcome to another episode of the Bites of Wisdom podcast. I am one of your hosts, John Bullum. This episode, Ozzy and I talk to Adam Cooper, a lawyer, cybersecurity professional, children's book author, who has a penchant for traveling the world. Adam talks to us about growing up in a suburb of Cleveland and how his father fed his curiosity for computers at a young age. Please sit back and enjoy.
Welcome back, listeners. Tonight, it's just John and I, but we have the pleasure of being joined by Adam Cooper. I'm going to intro him a little bit, and then we'll just let him add on to it, because I'm sure I haven't captured all of his qualifications and accomplishments. But just going back in chronological order, you have a BA in Michigan. My daughter goes to Wisconsin, so we're not going to talk about that.
Go blue. That's all I'm going to say. Go blue.
Yeah. You got your JD at Syracuse University College of Law. You did a little bit of time studying abroad at University of Western Cape in South Africa.
Wow.
You got a little bit, you have some experience in international law, some in national security and foreign policy. You're a children's book author. You're currently, I think, a SOC analyst. You can correct me if I'm wrong. At one point, you were an international compliance analyst. You're a term member at Council for Foreign Relations. You're a security fellow at the Truman National Security Project. You're a member of the DC Bar. You're an avid scuba diver.
That's true.
And you're a travel enthusiast, which, fun fact, you've visited all 7 continents. So that's pretty impressive as far as qualifications. And I got to say, you and I met maybe a couple of years ago through Minorities in Cybersecurity. And it's funny because I know of some of your accomplishments. I know you wrote the book, but it wasn't until I really dug at the end of the book, it listed some of these accomplishments. And I also went through LinkedIn as well and saw some of your past work history. And that's some of the work history is not even listed in that list that I went through. But I was pretty impressed by that. You've had a pretty extensive background, but I'll let you go ahead and introduce yourself a little bit further if there is more stuff to be highlighted.
No, that's a pretty good pump up to start, honestly. Thank you very much. Just thank you for having me on in general. A couple of things. I'm currently an international compliance analyst at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, but I will add at the top that anything I say and do here is for the United States of Adam Cooper. I'm not representing anybody else but myself at this moment, so I've got to get that legal disclaimer out of the way. It's, yeah, you went through quite a bit of the stuff I've done so far, and it's a little weird, as we were talking about before we started, pumping yourself up versus somebody else doing it. I was actually, last week, I was at this conference at the American Society of International Law, and I was doing the speed mentoring where I think they had 5 of us who had gone to law school. We're talking about current law students. And I graduated from law school in 2012, so it's technically been 12 years since I've been out of school. And having law students ask me about like my career path so far, and then having to talk through it, in back of my mind, I was like, damn, I've actually done a lot in the last 12 years. I don't really get to sit back and think and talk about it. And so that was...
Wait, you did all that in just the last 12 years?
Well, not counting undergrad, which was graduated from Michigan in 2009, but I started law school in 2009. Yes. Most of the stuff you listed, yeah, was 09 forward. Yes. But I'll add a couple of things. So I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio on Lake Erie. So I'm a diehard Cleveland sports fan. Fun fact, when the Cavs won in 2016, I drove from D.C. The day before the parade, went to the parade with my mother, and then drove right back to D.C. because Cleveland doesn't win very often. And fun fact, later that fall, the Cleveland baseball team was in the World Series. And so my dad and I went to Game 6, and it was a closeout game because they were up 3-2 on the Cubs. And I was like, what is 2016? We're going to just win everything now. And of course, they did end up winning because that's just how Cleveland sports goes. But so I've humbled me to know that the wins don't come very often. So when they do come, you got to celebrate them.
Yeah, which is the reason why I wanted to, instead of letting you intro yourself with your accomplishments, which I didn't think you were going to do.
I wasn't. You're right.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to do that. Yeah.
It's impressive. And shame on Ozzy for originally seeing if this man wanted us to mentor him.
Ozzy was mentor at first. Yeah. The monitors in the cybersecurity program. Ozzy was helping me write some essays and stuff. So it was pretty natural, I thought.
I really mean me, but.
Yeah. So Yeah. One of the things that kind of struck me as I was looking through your sort of career history, there are a couple of points that I think would give our listeners a deeper dive into who you are. In addition to your transformation or your transition to information security, which I think we can focus on that a little bit. I did notice a trend here with your work history that you have a good amount of past experience in positions of service to others. So you've volunteered to teach basic computer skills and English language to non-English speaking individuals. You work in a public defender's office. You were a resident peer advisor at University of Michigan, child marriage initiative consultant, study abroad facilitator, and I'm sure I'm missing some stuff. The list goes on and on. So I guess the first question is, there's a lot of positions of service there. So the pattern around that, was that intentional? And if so, was there anything specific that has driven you to take on so many positions of service?
That's an interesting question. The easy answer is no, that was not intentional, but let me add some color and context to that. I have to give thanks to my parents because they raised my brother and I to really understood how privileged we are or were as we were growing up. I was raised in a pretty homogenous suburb of Cleveland, Ohio called Strongsville. And my father, who actually retired a couple of years ago, he was an anesthesiologist. And my mom was a teacher for a minute, but my brother and I always had all of our basic needs met when we were growing up. We were the only people in most of the schools who looked like us. I went to a private Montessori school from kindergarten to eighth grade. Fun fact about a dome, I didn't have grades till high school. I went to a private Jesuit Catholic high school in Cleveland called St. Ignatius under a academic and athletic powerhouse. They just won states in basketball this past year in addition to soccer. And so my parents always either directly or indirectly pushed my brother and I to understand how privileged we were, and because of that was our obligation to give back. And my high school, you guys probably know about Catholic private high schools, they really are into the service. And the mantra of the St. Ignatius High School is men for others. And that was very hammered home even before I started attending school there. And my younger brother, who's 5 years younger, he also attended high school there. And I'll tell a short story that I think explains how I got this mindset. When I was younger, I'm the oldest, and my dad and I used to always butt heads on certain things. And I think I was maybe a sophomore, so this was like 2001, 2002. And my high school created this program. At the time, it was new, where on Sunday nights, they would gather at the high school and prepare basically just like meals. And then you would go out into downtown Cleveland and find homeless people and give them food and give them clothes and stuff. And it's called the St. Benedict Joseph Labor Project. I don't even know if it's still in existence anymore. But being the young, arrogant, stupid teenager that I was, I thought this was a stupid idea. Why was I going to waste my Sunday nights to go to this thing? But then my dad took me and I saw how some of these people were living. And I was, okay, I get it, how much privilege I have and how my basic needs are met. And I'm living a pretty good version of Earth at the moment. But yes, I get it. And I will try to give back. And so when the project started, you could just show up on a Sunday and you would get in a van and go out. And then I think when I was a junior, there was like a wait list to go on the program. So it had really exploded. And it's really eye-opening because you get to go meet these people, and being 15, 16, 17, or however old I was, just talking to people who are, you know, homeless and living on the street, just having a conversation with them, I really wasn't going to get that exposure anywhere else. And that's always stuck with me because I grew up in a very sheltered suburb. But my parents, they really hammered into us, okay, you guys got it good. You have to learn how the world actually works. So I appreciate that. I think that's probably why I have been so kind of service driven, because I do recognize my privilege. I'm always trying to pass information on and give back. So that's, I think, where that comes from.
Yeah, that's that story about going to hand out meals to the homeless. I had a sort of same experience, but much further in life. I was probably in my 30s. And it was one of those, at the company I work at, there's quite a significant volunteer effort there, and a program. And through one of those, we were at a soup kitchen. And I remember going to the soup kitchen and we're just feeding people. And I expected to see a line of just like homeless people. And that wasn't the case, right? There was some individuals that walked in there in suits. And you can tell that they were probably on the cusp of maybe becoming homeless. They still had the suit. They were probably looking for jobs, interviewing, and this is how they were getting their meals. You saw a lot of older people. You saw families that probably couldn't afford to feed their kids, and they were online with their kids. And it was a really eye-opening experience. And at that point, I said, my girls get older. I'm going to take them to do some volunteer work like this. I never got around to doing that. I regret that. Thankfully, that they're both really good people. And we were able to instill the same sort of attitude in them in other ways. But yeah, it's good that you got that as a teenager. I got it as an adult. So I got it much later in life. So let's touch a little bit about you have, like I said, we've gone through your background. It's quite an extensive background, a lot of international law. You got through JD. But at some point, you made a transition or a jump into cybersecurity. So what prompted that? What was the catalyst for you getting into that field?
So I've always had a fascination and a curiosity about computers. I mean, when I was growing up, I remember the day we got like our first like real desktop computer. It was a Gateway. It came in like a box that was as big as probably my desk with this huge monitor. And my parents actually let me set it up like in my bedroom. And so we had all the games and stuff, and I was learning about basic stuff. My dad taught me about disk cleanup and disk defragmenter, and I thought I was like the hot shit because I knew how to do that with people's computers and stuff. And so I've always had that curiosity about, one, computers, but also how technology impacts people's lives. And as I got older, even though technically now I'm looking at it a little bit directly, but I've always had that curiosity and just wanting to know what's going on with technology and how it's affecting human lives. And when I traveled, so in 2008, it was between my junior and senior year of undergrad at Michigan. I went with this program called World Teach that Harvard used to run. I think it folded up during the pandemic, actually. But it's like a JV version of the Peace Corps, where you don't go for 2 years, you go for 3 months or whatever, how long I was there. And so I was in Namibia on the African continent. I had never traveled by myself before. I don't think anybody in my immediate or really extended family had been over to the African continent before. So that was important for me to, because I wanted to go see it myself. And so it took me probably 3 days to get there. And I flew into Windhoek, which is the capital of Namibia. And then I got driven like 7 hours north to the, maybe 2 hours south of the Angolan border, because Namibia and Angola share a border. And I was literally in the middle of nowhere at this homestead, living with the principal of the school I was working at. And my job was to teach teachers at this school how to use computers and how to get on the internet. And the reason why I was there, and this is where the kind of international law piece of it comes into it. So Namibia split from South Africa in 1990. So the country is still relatively young. And their Ministry of Education, it's like their Department of Education equivalent for in the States, they passed a law that said that if you were a teacher, you had to have a certain level of computer proficiency. So my job when I was there was to help these teachers essentially pass a certification test. And when I got there, I had taken my college laptop with me. And I remember my first day, I get to the school, I go into the school's library, and the computers look like the ones that we opened up when I was a kid, like the Gateway, like the monitors were huge. It was on like Windows 95. And I was like, oh my gosh, Adam, what have you done? You're stuck here for 3 months. How are you going to make this work? But these teachers, they were very curious. I had to work a little bit harder with the female teachers because of some of the stereotypical gender roles. Some of the women didn't think that the computers were for them. But I think it definitely helped that I look like them. Because when I showed up, there was actually another volunteer. I actually got there late because I took the LSAT like the day before I left. There was another volunteer at the school who did not look like me. And I guess she had grown up in Boston or something and never really traveled before. And she didn't last 2 weeks. She had been there for a week and said, get me out of here. I want to go home. So I show up thinking I'm like nervous and stuff. And everyone at the school is like, are you going to leave right away? And I didn't understand that narrative until about 2 weeks later, but that was my introduction to it. And so I spent my whole summer teaching these teachers that were a lot older than me how to do basic things like drag and drop, how to copy and paste, to explain what the internet was. So that kind of really got me open to the fact that I'm part of the micro part of millennials from 97 to 82, where I remember my life before the internet, but it's not that clear. Like I remember using Google for the first time, but it's always been there. So I've always been interested in technology. Because of that, I've always kept an eye on what's happening with technology. And so I've used that in every kind of job that I've had, basically until the job that I have now in some way, shape, or form. I'm either working with the internet, human rights, or technology.
Fascinating. I like the line, I left the day after I took my LSAT.
I took the LSAT and I just, not the best planning. I wouldn't recommend that for anybody, but
I don't know about that. I was more impressed than anything else.
I was impressed.
Yeah.
One of the questions I had, like bringing a little bit back. So what are you doing right now? We talked in the beginning about, or Ozzy mentioned in the beginning about the book you just published. I want to talk about that. But tell us what you're doing right now. Like, you work as an international compliance analyst at the Non-Proliferation Program. Sorry, I knew I wasn't going to be able to say that word.
It's okay. It's called Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. It's run by the Department of Energy. And this lab has deep history with the Manhattan Project and Oppenheimer. Right. Like, all of the plutonium and uranium that was enriched during World War II was enriched actually where the base of where the lab is headquartered in Richland, Washington. And having a legal background, I'm working on non-proliferation regulations. So looking at how countries, basically based on the NPT treaty, which was passed in 1970, it's the hallmark of non-proliferation law. And so I'm working on a host of programs across the space that's both domestic and international. And so it's a big shift, because at the Department of State, when I was working at the Homeland Security, I was doing more risk management and operational type work. But working for federal law enforcement is very different than what I'm doing now. And I will add that my current job is pretty much 100% remote, which I actually love. I didn't think I would like it as much, but it's actually really nice. So that's an interesting vibe. And so the cyber piece of this that I'm trying to get more introduction to at the lab is that a lot of the nuclear security system, they're what I would consider their legacy systems because of when they were created. And as you both know, it's hard to update those effectively. And so the physical security around nuclear power and energy and weapons is pretty good. But when you bring in some of the cyber stuff, you have to really have a really strong, I would say, framework for writing the policy, but also figuring out how you're going to implement it. It's still very new. I've only been doing it for, I think this is month four. So I would say I'm still being hazed with all the information and stuff. But no, it's really interesting. Like I said, it's very different than what I was doing before. So I was ready to try something new. And going back to what Ozzy was saying earlier, so I had been looking to get out of what I was doing before, and I got hooked up with Minorities in Cybersecurity, and I did the Mike Lead program. That's how I met Ozzy virtually. And then I met him last year at the conference. So I got to give a shout out to Mary Chaney, because she's doing some amazing things with that organization.
Yeah, the intention is to have her on here as a guest as well. I actually had dinner with her last night, so we have to get that scheduled up.
So tell us about your book.
Sure. Yes.
So, how'd you get? So I do have to say, I found out you had a book, immediately ordered it. I'm looking forward to reading it with my children, because it looks like a great way. And this is for me just looking at it on Amazon. I haven't gotten it yet, but it looks like a great way to introduce children to computers, cyber aware. My daughter's starting to ask about YouTube and things that were social media.
So generally, writing comes pretty natural to me. And during the pandemic, when the pandemic was at its height, I'll say, so this was maybe in 2021. So I have a goddaughter who was five at the time, and I was hanging out with her. She's local in the DMV also. And one day she just took my phone and was just like navigating to where all my games were. And I was working at State at the time, so I was very like security focused and stuff. And I was like, wow, like not only did she know how to get into my phone, but she knew where all the games were. Like, who's talking to her about cybersecurity? And being godfather, I'm always looking at, okay, what can I like give her? Or you know, whenever I travel, I bring back stuff. And so I did a peer review, and there aren't that, at least at the time, there were not really any comprehensive resources for kids on cybersecurity. And that kind of blew my mind, because being internationally focused, there are kids in China and Russia and stuff that are much better than they have resources of speaking three languages and stuff like that. And I was like, wow, this is a problem, especially for people who look like me of African descent. I think that we're the most vulnerable on the internet, because we're the most attacked. Like, people go after them for phishing schemes and stuff like that. And so I was like, all right, there's nothing out there. So I guess I got to figure out how to create this. I started writing a little bit, and I, through my national security network, I met a really good friend of mine. Her name's Amanda Kiemerer, and she actually became like my accountability sibling. That's what we call each other, because she actually also was working on creating her book. And so we would talk probably like once or twice a month about how we were going along with this. I wrote the book, all the text, and then that was the end of my creative juices, because I don't really draw very well. I would not have been able to come up with the illustration. And so I was at a local artist market in Baltimore. I think that was in 2021, because my wife has a side business, so she was selling there. And this author, she had this other artist, she painted this awesome huge print, and I have it over my desk. It's of the ancestral plane from Black Panther, where T'Challa's walking to meet his dad. And so I bought this huge painting, and I have it over my desk. And after I had finished writing the book, I looked at it, and I was like, okay, this person has to illustrate my book. So I contacted her, like I found like the receipt in Square, I found her email, we started talking more. And her name is Latasha Maddox, and she's based in Baltimore. She's a fantastic artist. And so she never illustrated a book before.
So it was a learning process for both of us. I explained my vision. I told her I wanted to use animals. Rhino is my favorite land animal. So I told her kind of my idea for this. I wanted it to be like Berenstain Bears, Magic School Bus for the new generation. And so we would talk probably quarterly. We split the book up into four sections. So she would do, I think we had 32 pages. So she would do 8 illustrations. We would talk, we would edit and stuff. And we would go forward with that. But it was very, it took probably almost 2 years to get the whole thing done from start to finish. So it was basically just in my free time. I would put blocks on my calendar to write. I would check in with her periodically. It was, you really learn about yourself when you're creating something, because there's nobody else, aside from my wife asking me where I was with that, there was really nobody else that was keeping me accountable. So you have to do it yourself. I think Tox finished all the illustrations early in 23. And then I'd done quite a bit of travel, which we had talked about. And then when I left the State Department in the end of October 2023, I took all November off. I'd never done this before. I just took a sabbatical, went to 4 Michigan football games with a buddy of mine, which is awesome. But I also spent all my time trying to finish this damn book. December 3rd, 2023, I self-published everything on Amazon and now it's available. Yeah.
It's going to be here tomorrow. I'm looking forward to it.
I don't want to spoil anything for you, John.
You say what you need to say. I'll
just take his headphones off.
There are two things in the book that were interesting and fascinating. First of all, I love how you open the book by explaining how computers over the internet connect to each other. And you talked about the C cables.
Yes.
Nobody, now I have a little bit of my background's in networks, and nobody really talks about that, right?
No, everyone thinks it's satellites. The people don't know it's cable. Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty cool. The other thing I thought was interesting was the teacher's name. Right.
Oh yeah.
Mrs. Collision. Yeah. And I was like, wait a minute. Is there a backstory to that? Or how did you pick that name?
No, just, I don't want to get away, but I am working on more. So I'm actually working on this second book already. Mrs. Collision will make a comeback, but John, I don't want to spoil it for you, but the villain in the story obviously gets to her. So that's why I decided to write it that way. But there's more coming with her. I just got to figure out how I'm going to do it.
Okay. Yeah. I suspected something, and I was going to ask you. Now we know. I was going to ask you if there were any more books in your future coming, but...
Yes, no. And thankfully, I got to give a shout out to Tosh, because I actually talked to her last week and she agreed to illustrate the second book. So it's on me to write all the text and figure out how I want everything to look. And then we're going to go from there. So I have a little bit of homework ahead of me.
Nice. I've from time to time contemplated like maybe writing a book. Just contemplated though. I've gotten past just thinking about it.
We edit this podcast, Ozzy, together.
Yeah.
Could you imagine writing a book alone?
No. No, I couldn't.
Kudos to you, man.
Thank you. Appreciate that. It's not to downplay it, but it's not as daunting as you think it is if you break it up into sections. Because like I sat down for the first time. And I was like, all right, I got to create a children's book. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to come up with everything in this sitting. I have to do an outline. I can't tell you how many times I came back, and I don't really view myself as a perfectionist, even though my wife will say I am, but I try to just get things finished over perfect. But with this damn book, I was changing things like every other day. And it was really annoying because you think you have it where you want it. And then you like go take a walk or something and something comes. You're like, oh, I got to go back and fix that. So I told myself, all right, this is the cutoff date. I'm making no creative changes and that's it. Because otherwise you'll never get it done.
Did you leverage any individuals like to bounce ideas off of them? It's one thing that I've heard, I forgot what podcast I was listening to, and this guy said when he was writing books, what was this guy's name? He wrote a book with Oprah at one time. He said,
for Phil?
No, this is, I'll get the name and come back to you, but not anybody that well known. But he said he'd have these ideas and he'd write sections of the book and then he would bring like close friends and other people together and bounce the ideas off of them to see what would stick or what was a good idea. And then if it worked, then great. And there would be tons of editing that happened after that. But if it didn't work and the idea didn't hit, then he'd scrap it and start from square one. So I was wondering if you did any of that at all, or did you just go to alone completely?
No. So my friend Amanda, I bounce ideas off of her quite a bit. And then I have to give credit to my wife, Christina, because she actually sat with the book, because when you get too close to it, it becomes your thing.
You remember that from Minorities and Cybersecurity?
Yes, yeah.
Do you?
Yes.
From the writing?
I do. Yeah. I do remember it visibly. Yes. Yeah. So she had it and she gave her feedback and stuff and pointers on it, which I thought was helpful because when I write, I tend to just think that my way or the highway. So I was like, all right, you just take it and tell me what you think about it, and then we'll talk about it afterward. Yes, I think that's important, but you have to be honest with yourself. If you want feedback, do you actually want it, or do you just want your viewpoints confirmed? And there's those are two very different places to be.
Yeah, absolutely. John, what I was referring to just now is when Minorities in Cybersecurity, when he started this LEED program, the applicants had to apply and they also had to write an essay about why they should be considered for the program. And the first, I think, two cohorts, I agreed with Mary to read through the essays. And I said, instead of just reading through the essays, why don't we read through the essays? I'll do some light commenting, or where maybe there was some grammatical, some spelling issues, and then sit with the individuals and just did like speed rounds, like 10 minutes
to get to know them a little bit. And
then just to explain to them, hey, listen, I sent them some comments on Google Docs and would go over it and give them pointers. And then they would come back again a second time and rewrite it and try to fix some of the mistakes. And then if they were good after that, then I gave them something brand new to write for the third time. Or some people it took them three tries to get through it. One of the things that I told those individuals, like, listen, anytime you're putting a lot of time into something like writing or creating a PowerPoint, whatever it is, especially if your head's down on this for hours in, you got to step away from this thing. You got to, especially when you think you're done, right? When you think you're done, close the laptop, go to bed, come back the next morning.
Fresh.
Yeah. Because the next morning, what you're doing is you're coming back in and you're probably not looking at it through the lens of the creator. You're looking at it as a consumer. You're reading it as if somebody else would. Got a little tear in my eye, Adam, when you said you were.
No, you had some good pointers. Yeah, no, that was helpful.
So I wanted to just move away from the work stuff a little bit. And last year, that conference where we physically met, and I was on a panel, and I mentioned, I can't even remember really why I mentioned this, but I mentioned my like for Hans Zimmer, the film score composer. And after the panel discussion was over, you came up to me and maybe it was during the panel. You said, oh man, I love Hans Zimmer as well. And we caught up about that. And I know in prepping for this recording, we talked about it a little bit, that Hans is like your go-to when you're deep in work. So give me a little bit of like, how did you get to Hans Zimmer? And then I have a fun fact for you once you're done.
Sure. In general, musical scores have always intrigued me, whether it's movies or I'm really into Japanese anime and that kind of stuff. No matter what you're watching, a good scene is sometimes made or broken with the right melody. I grew up watching Dragon Ball Z on Toonami, and I can't imagine watching it without the Falconer score. For all my fans out there who know about Dragon Ball Z, when they changed it to Dragon Ball Z Kai, I can't even watch it because the music and the voices are off, and it's just not the same thing. But Hans is just the goat to me. Let's just settle that right now. So
yeah,
I think the starter for me with Batman Begins, because Batman's kind of always been my favorite. And if you remember when Batman Begins was made, it was the response to how badly done the George Clooney Batman movies were, where we had like a break.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that? Like Batman was really on.
It was like a good 10 years, right?
Right. It was Batman was on the outs and they didn't know what to do with it. But they found this director named Christopher Nolan and they gave him the chance to do it. And I think he had done Memento at that point. Yep. Nolan's my favorite director, so I think it was a perfect merge of those. But the Batman Begins soundtrack, that came out in 2005. So that was transformative for me because that was between, so I graduated from high school in June 05, then I started in Michigan in August. And so that summer, I think I saw Batman Begins three times in theaters because I was just obsessed with it. But the music just blew me away. And then I started doing more digging into who Hans Zimmer was and his stuff. And after that, I decided anything Hans Zimmer does, I'm going to listen to it. And so we got the three Batman films. I actually think Hans Zimmer's best movie work is actually with Man of Steel. Even though the film itself doesn't get as much love, but the music he did to bring Superman back was just, it's amazing to me. He also did some music in The Amazing Spider-Man 2, where Andrew Garfield played Spider-Man. He did a couple things for that. I think he's done most of Christopher Nolan's films, so like Inception and Tenet, he did the score for all that stuff. And that's, to me, I just have always loved instrumental because the music doesn't have any words, so you're not caught singing along. But as we were talking about before, there have been times when I'm sitting down to write and I'll have a Hans Zimmer score on and I'll catch myself and I'll be like,
damn, I got to go watch the scene now. I can't just sit here and listen to this music. I got to go actually watch the scene.
But when I'm going to sit down and write or be focused on something, I have a playlist on my, you know, iTunes, and it's most of his stuff. So it's Batman Begins, Dark Knight Rises, Man of Steel, Inception, and Tenet. And it's a very long playlist, and I'll either shuffle or I go directly through it. And that just gets me in the writing mood.
So you mentioned something there that I wanted to touch on before I get to the fun fact about Hans Zimmer, but the score of a movie is sometimes, like you said, it can really make the movie. I don't know too many examples where it would break the movie. If a movie's bad, the movie's bad. If a movie's great, then you just, a bad score, you won't notice a score, but I don't think it would break it as much as it would enhance it. But I don't know if you've ever seen Sicario.
Oh, yeah.
The movie with, so that movie, the first time I watched it afterwards, I was like, man, wow, that was a great movie. So much action. And then I thought about it. I said, really no action in that movie. Besides the border scene, there was really no action in that movie, but the score
made you feel like there was
so intense. Like even the opening scene, it was so intense that I walked away. Wow, that was a great action movie. And like I said, there was barely any action in that movie. So a good film score can really put a movie over the top. And that border scene in Sicario, one of my three favorite scenes of all time, not favorite movies, but favorite scenes. I have three really scenes that I love, and for all different reasons. There's
with the van,
the shootout scene,
the shootout
in downtown.
Yeah.
Like that, the audio to that was so amazing. And you look at it, if you look at the sort of making of it, research it, when he picked the location, the acoustics down there were so great. They just ended up putting mics on the lampposts for the streets.
I didn't know that. Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was amazing. The third scene that I love is just for a completely different reason. It has nothing to do with the soundtrack or audio. It was a movie, The Kingdom, with Jamie Foxx, Jennifer Garner, Jason Bateman. The end of that movie, when there was a scene where there was a lot of action. It was like action-packed, and Jason Bateman gets kidnapped, and Jamie Foxx and Jennifer Garner, they had to go rescue him. And there was a point where Jennifer Garner and Jason Bateman were fighting for their lives, like, against these terrorists. And wow, like, you just got to watch it. It's amazing. So it was like, I have three scenes where I will sit down on a slow Friday or Saturday night and just play those scenes. Not watch the movie, just play those scenes. But often the score is what does it for me and puts it over the top for me. So that's, I agree with you. Hans Zimmer, hands down the GOAT. Now, the fun fact. Did you know that he did two songs on Cool Runnings, the movie?
I did know that, actually. Yes.
You didn't know
I
that.
Did know
good.
That. Yeah.
See, now I know you're a real fan.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Somebody had mentioned that to me. We were talking about Cool Runnings at work, and somebody said, yeah, Hans Zimmer did some music on it. I was like, what?
Yeah,
but I rewatched the movie and saw his name in the credits.
See, that hits differently, though, because like when I was a kid and I watched Cool Runnings, I didn't know who Hans Zimmer was. So like it meant nothing to me at the time. And I was just sitting along enjoying it. But now you're right. I went back and watched it, and like, I was like, okay, wow, he definitely did do this.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I did. Yeah. Another bit of trivia or something where you and I, at least back in the conference, connected on. Yeah. We can go. I'm not even going to turn this into an episode on movies and film scores. Cause
I'm holding back what I think is the best scene I've seen. So
don't hold back. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Sure. No, John. Yeah. Go ahead.
Fourth episode of True Detective season 1, man.
Oh, episode.
Is that the
True
single
Detective
shot
season?
Where they're just running
the
through?
Single
yes,
shot.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yes.
Yeah.
It's like the back of a motel, I think, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I have to rewatch True Detective season 1. It was amazing. But for some strange reason, what I have ingrained in my memory is season 2, season 3, season 4.
Horrible. See, I liked all of the seasons for different reasons. But
oh my God.
True Detective season 1 was a masterpiece.
Yeah.
And that fourth episode where that single shot. And there's another episode. There's another show that I think was an excellent shot too. It's, I'm trying to remember the episode, which episode it is, but of the bear, where there's a scene where they're opening up the, I think it's the, it might be the last episode.
Where they open up the restaurant. Yeah.
Where they open up the restaurant.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh my God. That tension in that episode is just crazy. And yeah, those are two really good television shows, but I hear you on True Detective. I don't want to turn this into a argument, Ozzy, because I like that whole, I just finished the fourth season and I thought it was good.
No, John, I got to disagree. I think the second season, is that the one with Colin Farrell and Vince Vaughn?
Yes.
Yeah, that's no go territory
the worst.
For me. Yeah.
No, I'm not going to say it was the best season of television I've ever seen, but it wasn't horrible.
So if I had to, season one is up here.
Oh, season one's way up here. Yes.
Then for me, season two goes whoop.
Yeah.
And then season three goes whoop. Now season four,
really?
Yeah. And I think season four jumps above two and three.
Yes.
I think it was better than two and three, but nowhere close to one.
I think season three was better than season two.
I would have to agree with that.
Really?
Yeah.
That's the one with Marshall Ali and Stephen Dorff.
Yeah. That was an amazing season.
Yeah. The time travel stuff was interesting there when they were going back and forth with all the point in their lives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why. It didn't connect with me.
I think that the first season set such a high bar. That was just an amazing piece of television. And then, the rest are just difficult. Now I just finished watching, Night Country, season four. I thought it was great. And I thought that I didn't think we were going to another season. And I guess technically we did, but we didn't because it wasn't Nick, the original guy, didn't actually film it. It was another director, but it was still great. And they're doing a fourth season too.
Oh, really? He came out and criticized the director.
Did he really?
He had criticism for her about the current director, which
there's
I thought was
There's nothing wrong with criticism, but dude, the dude was a producer on it as well.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it, but it's a slippery slope and it's tough to do when you've done it before. It's like Christopher Nolan.
He didn't do it before.
Like Christopher Nolan coming out and criticizing like the previous director for Batman. You just let your work stand on its own. You stay away from that.
Oh, man. I hear you. Okay, I hear you.
Yeah.
It would have been, sure. Was it a Brucker? Whoever did the George Clooney Batman? Anything that guy produces.
Yeah.
My thing with Batman is if you don't get the villain right, the film is not going to be good. And the villains in the Clooney Batman movies were just a joke. And that's why the rest of them, and the converse, that's also why in the Nolan trilogy.
Even Val Kilmer, like the Batman.
They weren't great, but they weren't as bad as Schwarzenegger's Freeze and stuff. But the Nolan trilogy, the only reason why, I think Christian Bale was a good Batman, but I don't think he was great. But the reason why the Nolan trilogy was good is because they nailed the villain every time.
Heath Ledger and then Tom Hardy.
Tom Hardy. I mean, wow.
But Heath Ledger was like,
hands
down, one of the greatest villain performances I've seen.
It's the role that killed him.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Joker, the one with,
oh my God,
Joaquin Phoenix. Like the movie itself was not bad. I didn't think it was super amazing. But he was amazing in it.
Yeah, he was
amazing.
They're making another one.
They are.
Or they made another one.
With Lady Gaga, which I'm not sure about. What did you think about the Batman with Robert Pattinson?
I liked it, but I don't want to go down a comic book tangent. But if we're going to compare what Marvel has done to make their products, I would say pretty stellar across the board generally and have some direction. The DC universe, if you even call it that, is just a blender. It's just a mess. And I don't get why that film needs to be made if you're not going to connect it or even have them be in like a different universe in DC.
But you can make the same argument about the Joker.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, I agree. There's not like a common theme. We're just randomly pumping out content. I'm like, all right, what's the point of all this?
I thought that Robert Pattinson's Batman, I liked it a lot because I thought it was something different. Like it was more like a detective film. And to me, like it had the vibes of like old detective film and just not the like adrenaline Batman that we've been used to for the last 15 or whatever years.
It was a nice twist on what's the, is it The Long Night, the comic book arc that one was based on. I think it was a decent twist on that also.
So what I didn't like about the Robert Pattinson Batman, I'm very particular with my like visual aesthetic from movies that are dark. I don't like it at all. There are some movies that are like not great movies, but lit, good cinematography. Like the first season of, oh my God, what was the show? Oh my God. With Kevin Spacey, where he was the president.
House of Cards.
Yeah.
House of Cards. The first season, I remember watching some of those seasons. I'm like, man, this thing is lit so well. I got to look this up. I'll tell you this other movie that
tell was, me your, tell, what are your thoughts on like Sin City though?
I never saw Sin City.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. We should change topics here because we're going to get on this. We're going to get on this rabbit hole and I'm going to get exposed because there's so many movies that I haven't seen.
I have one thing you mentioned, started with George Clooney. Spoilers for anyone. What was your thought at the end of The Flash?
Oh man, I don't want to.
It should have been Ben Affleck. It should have been any of the other ones other than George Clooney. I think it was George Clooney because they were giving everyone the finger at the end.
I want to answer and also cut off this conversation because we're going to go down too much of a rabbit hole. But I was hyped for The Flash when it was being made. But then all the stuff with Ezra Miller and them marketing it to death, I was like, this is headed nowhere positive. And it pissed me off because they wasted an awesome rendition of Supergirl. She was the best part of that film, and there wasn't really much else. Honestly, the only reason why I bought my ticket is because, wait a minute, Michael Keaton's coming back, or I have to go see this.
Yes.
And then they wasted him, and I was like,
they did.
Yeah, but that's going nowhere positive, so yeah, let's just...
No comment.
No comment.
That means I didn't see it.
No, that's fine. You're probably better off, actually.
Honestly, they could have recut that movie into 25 minutes, and it would have been better.
So the movie I was trying to remember was The Murder on the Orient Express.
Mm. Oh, okay.
The most recent one. It wasn't a great movie, but again, it was the cinematography like was crisp, good, vibrant colors, very well lit. I enjoyed that. For some reason, that does it for me. But all right, back on track here. Because we just spent the last 20 minutes. Listen, that's how this goes, right? We get on, we start talking about stuff and we end up going down rabbit holes. But I think we're coming to time. I just wanted to give you an opportunity. I know we've discussed so much already. We'll let you close it out. And if there's any other sort of any personal interest that you may have or any sort of aspirations in your professional life that you want to highlight, and we can just close the episode on that.
Sure. So I'll answer in backwards order. When I was younger, like before I had a career being in school and stuff, I had written down kind of goals for myself. And one of them was, okay, I want to work at the UN. That was actually my first job out of law school. So
I was going to say, you haven't?
Yes. No, I did already. It was my first job out of law school.
I was saying that as a joke.
Yeah, no. And so
I saw it on there.
I had to rethink a little bit about, okay, I got to rethink this stuff. So now that I'm a little bit older and I've, experienced stuff now, honestly, I just want to have enough means to go keep exploring the world travel-wise and meeting people and getting exposed to things because we're all stuck in a capitalist system, but it doesn't mean we can't use it to our advantage when we can. And so that's my mindset with that. So I really don't have any big career aspirations at the moment. I guess on the middle of personal professional, I do want to crank out more children's books because I think I did it pretty quickly and now I have a system in place and an illustrator who I really like working with. So that's one thing I want to keep doing. Interest related to travels. In 2018, my wife and I got certified to scuba dive, and we've been doing that for, that's 2018, so that's about 6 years now. And when I was younger, I actually used to be afraid of the water. And so this is my like conquering fear moment. And my parents and I laugh about this. My dad's always like, man, I remember when you were afraid to put your head under the water, and now you're going 100 meters deep. And that has been very transformative and really just relaxing for me in a couple of different ways. I've been diving for 6 years now, and I've been able to go to some really awesome places. Like my wife and I, we got certified in Mexico. I dove in Zanzibar in Tanzania. We did our honeymoon in Australia, so I've been in the Great Barrier Reef. And then I've dove in Belize, Channel Islands in California, and I was actually just in Mexico and Cabo last month, and I did some diving there too. And exploring the ocean when you dive, really, if you do it right, it really forces you to realize how small and innocent as a kid you are. Because you get into the water the current maybe pulling you, there's birds flying by, there's fish going by, there's sharks and stuff. And then you go, and then once you make your descent, you're down there, there's millions of coral reefs, there's fish going around and stuff, and all this stuff happening. And you realize, wow, we're sitting up here above sea level fighting about something that doesn't mean anything at all. And so I always try and dive at least once per year. We'll see how it goes going forward. But just to remind myself of that and how significant we are, because I think that it's a big pipe dream. But if everybody actually had a chance to scuba dive, we would have world peace. Like, no question. If everyone had a chance to go relax like that, because my wife will laugh when I say this, but I like scuba diving because when you're down there, nobody can talk to you. It's just your breath and the ocean. That's it. And you never know what you're going to see on a dive. I've seen turtles, dolphins. I've seen sharks. I've seen jellyfish. I've seen eels. I've seen everything. And it really just, it's calming to me. And I really enjoy that. And so I've always tried to fold that into travel. But I will add that, I recognize that it's expensive. I'm talking about this from an extremely privileged background. But at the same time, I have never been on a dive boat where someone else who looked like me was diving also. There have been people there who were working who looked like me, but I've been the only person who looks like me going on a dive boat. And so this whole idea and this kind of Eurocentric white supremacist mindset about exploration and being able to go to places with your own free will, I try to explore a lot because I know that my ancestors could not. And so that's my thing when it comes to travel. I think I actually mentioned this in the back flap of the book, but I have already walked on every continent on planet Earth. We checked off Antarctica last February. I thought it was going to take a lot longer to get there, but I'm a pretty good hawk when it comes to travel deals. And last December, we saw a deal with this company, and it was essentially 2-for-1. And we had 3 days to decide if we were going to do it. And it was really expensive, but I could not be more grateful that we did it, because going to see Antarctica and watching the glaciers and the ice and stuff, and there's no depth perception, because most places you go, if you're going to take a picture, you usually see two things. You either see another human being or a tree. In Antarctica, there's neither of those. So when you look, you're like, oh, that's not that far. And someone pulls out their measurement thing. It's like about 5 miles away. Like, what? That's crazy to me. That was really eye-opening to me. And Oz, you'll appreciate this. So on the boat, there was one other guy who looked like me. And since we saw each other, we did the head nod and we became friends. We still talk to this day. I was like, man, I can't believe that shit. We actually went to Antarctica. It's crazy.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Listen, you had me with that whole diving stuff until you said sharks. And at that point, I got to tell you, everything else is beautiful. You see the fish, you see the turtles, coral reefs, but
the shark.
Yeah, the sharks. I have a fear of big bodies of water as well. And I don't know. Maybe one day I'll work to get over it. You know, but
I used to be like that, but I'm thankful that I had one parent who put my brother and I in things like swimming. Growing up, we were the only kids who looked like us when I swim lessons and stuff. And I'm very grateful for that, because a lot of people learned how to swim when they were growing up. That's a big luxury, and that's privilege. And so if I hadn't learned how to swim, I would not have been able to just jump into scuba diving when I had the time and means to do it. And so I'm very grateful for that. But honestly, I think I have maybe like 70 dives total at this point in my life. And I've seen sharks on maybe 10 of them. I will tell you, on one dive, I don't think they're very dangerous, but they're called nurse sharks. They're called the couch potatoes of the ocean because they're pretty lazy. And I had to take my GoPro with me on every dive. And so I'm videoing it, and the shark just stopped in front of me. And I took my GoPro up, and I actually started petting the shark, and it started like swimming with me the whole time. Yeah. And of course, I fed it to my mother, and she's like, how dare you pet this shark? What's wrong with you? And I was like, Mom, that was like 9 hours ago. Like, I'm fine.
Oh, wow.
Oh my God. Oh my God. My blood pressure is going up.
Right there, Ozzy.
Yeah. Oh my God. I see all the videos and all like similar videos. And I'm like, man, how did you just not crap your suit?
I'll have to send you some videos. I have them on my phone. I'll have to share them with you.
Yeah. Oh my God. Listen, hats off to you, man. Listen, like I said, I'm prepping for this recording. The one thing that I realized, I didn't know as much about you as I thought I knew. And your background and your approach, even to like the travel, and already you've hit all 7 continents. Like, that stuff is pretty impressive. And that's what, just to go back to how we opened, that's why I wanted to change the opening. Instead of you describing what you've done, I wanted to lay it out for you, because I didn't think you were going to do it. And you've even admitted that you probably wouldn't have done it.
No, not like
and,
you did. No, because that's, so thank you.
Because that's how I'm wired as well. I just wouldn't have done it. And John is, I think, the same way. So I just wanted to do that. And listen, this is a pleasure. This is cool. It was great chatting with you and even riffing on the movie stuff and the film score. And even that stuff was like good to go off on those tangents. But yeah, man, it was good. We enjoyed this. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. This was fun.
Thank you for listening to another episode of our podcast. To support us, please subscribe on LinkedIn, Apple, Spotify, and YouTube. We love feedback. You can reach us at feedback@biteswisdom.com. Until next time, stay curious.